This week on The Big Show, we bring you highlights from the red carpet from the U.S. premiere of Mission Impossible Fallout. The cast will join us to share their stories of working together and the impact the series has on the public's imagination. Plus, the co-writer of the biographical crime film and winner of the Cannes Film Fest Grand Prix Award, Black Klansman, Kevin Willmott, will be our special guest to discuss working with Spike Lee and the process of bringing Ron Stallworth's bizarre story to the big screen. In addition, we'll have entertainment news and reviews of the latest films, including the aforementioned Mission Impossible Fallout, all on the latest episode of Keeping It Real with Film Gordon. Let's go. And welcome to the latest episode of The Big Show, Keeping It Real with Film Gordon. I am Tim Gordon, and, you know, I always try to give you a weather report at the top of every show. Nice day. I mean, the last week or so, we've been having, you know, hurricane, monsoon, flash flood, and all kind of stuff. I'm going to take it. It still may rain today, though. We don't know. But right now, it is beautiful out here in the nation's capital, live from our studios here at 96.3 HD4. And if you're listening at home, that's dcradio.gov. We have a nice show for you today. Coming up a little later on, we had the pleasure of being the only film show on the red carpet that got into the premiere of Mission Impossible. We'll have all the cast, Tom Cruise, Angela Bassett, and more will all be on the show a little later on. Plus, a really good friend of mine who I've known now for about 15 years, writer-director Kevin Willmott, who, you know, came to prominence with CSA and Destination Planet Negro, is going to be on our show today. He has been co-writing with Spike Lee his last two films. He co-wrote Chi-Raq and Black Klansman, which hits theaters next week. So we're going to talk to him. And also, Wilson Morales will be here momentarily to talk to us about what's going on in film. And we'll have reviews of that one movie that's opening this week, Tom Cruise's sixth installment from the Mission Impossible franchise. This will be Fallout. So without any further ado, let me go straight to my phone lines. And it's Wilson Morales up in New York City. Wilson, how are you today, sir?
I'm doing pretty good.
All right, Wilson. So you just literally came back from Comic-Con, man. So give us a rundown there before we get to what's happening. What came out of Comic-Con that was hot last week?
You know, there's always a lot of stuff that you get shown at Comic-Con, whether it's TV series or films. Obviously, Saturday is always a big day. But this year was a little bit light since Marvel wasn't there to bookend the day, and Hall H was just where a lot of people go see stuff. So we had Warner Brothers, and they put on a show. You know, so we got to see a new trailer of Fantastic Beasts and the Crimes of Grindelwald, I think it is, in which you had a surprise appearance by Johnny Depp. You also had the first trailer for Aquaman, which looks impressive. And you also had a new trailer for, the first trailer for Godzilla. I forgot the rest of the title of it.
Yeah, it's called King of Monsters. Godzilla, King of Monsters.
King of Monsters.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we also got a trailer for Shazam. So basically, Warner Brothers came out with a lot of firsts, which excited a lot of fans. And I think what makes Hall H is when you bring more people. It's always interesting. If you bring one person in there, I don't know if they can carry a whole audience of 6,000. But when you bring more than one person, like everybody, I think for each one of the films, they at least had four cast members, you know, and that helped out. You know, so that was pretty good. And then the day before that, we got to see the first trailer for Glass, which is the film that M. Night Shyamalan is doing, which combines the movie that he did with Sam Jackson and Bruce Willis, along with Split, that starred James McAvoy.
Yeah, that's going to be hot, man. I've checked out the trailer for that. That drops in January. Yeah, all right, Wilson, so anything else, any other notable news that came out of Comic-Con?
Well, yeah, you know, they also showed Halloween, which is obviously the sell to that Jamie Lee Curtis is back. You know, and Halloween's not the same without Laurie Strode. You know, if you don't mention the Strode family, nothing else matters. So he was there. I think it piqued up a lot of interest. We're talking 40 years later, and people still want to see it. You had Spider-Man, something part of the Spider-Verse, an animated Spider-Man featuring Miles Morales, played by or voiced by Tamek Moore, who came out of the movie Dope.
Right. Yeah, that's hot.
You got a number of different things there.
Yeah, that's hot, man. All right, okay, so that's pretty good. So has everything more or less quieted down, man, since Comic-Con is over? We're still at the end of the very end of July. We're really about to hit the dog days next month of summer as it relates to releases. Is there anything you foresee on the forefront, coming up down the line, or are we really getting ready to prepare for, like, major festival season with Telluride next month, TIFF or the Toronto International Film Fest in September, et cetera?
Well, I think, you know, as you mentioned before, August is normally like a dog month. But sometimes you'll get, like, certain releases that try to play well. You can see August would be the time period where a black film would come out and do well. You know, we had The Butler, we had Jackie Brown, the James Brown Story. You had, what was the movie about Octavia Spencer and Viola Davis?
You're talking about Widows?
No. The one that came out a year ago. Octavia Spencer, Viola Davis.
Oh, you're talking about The Help.
Dallas Howard.
Oh, The Help. Yeah, The Help.
The Help. Yeah. Usually movies like that would do well in August, but there's nothing like that this year. So, you know, you're going to get films like Meg, you know, shark movies. At this point right now, these are movies that Pluto's didn't think could compete with the Jurassic Parks and the Mission Impossibles, you know, the guaranteed blockbusters. So they say, okay, let's play it in August and let's see how well we can do. There's got to be at least one sleeper film in August. And then by the time you get to the end of August, people will start concentrating on festivals because then we'll start in the heart of the Oscar season. Well, at the beginning of the Oscar season, you know, you're going to get Telluride and then you get Toronto right in the first week of September. You're still going to get, in a way, the dog days in September, and those movies that get played out in the festival will start appearing towards the end of September.
You're absolutely right, man. And, you know, we have to talk offline because you've given me some advice about these festivals. And you were absolutely right. So I think there might be a shot for you and I to attend some of these festivals coming up. So I think we're pretty good.
Yeah. You know, Toronto just released some of their, the first wave of their releases of what's going out to the festival. And, you know, you've got Barry Jenkins' If Beale Street Could Talk. You've got George Tillman Jr.'s The Hate U Give. You've got Steve McQueen's Widow starring Viola Davis. You've got Stella McGee's film The Weeknd. You got Monsters and Men, which played at Sundance, you know, mm-hmm. that's going to go there. But there's a number of films that have interest, along with, like, A Star is Born, which features Dave Chappelle back on a big screen in a supporting role.
Yeah, Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga. Yeah, it looks good. I saw the trailer. I mean, you know, I initially was saying how many more of these Star is Born films we'd have to make. I think this is the fourth one, I want to say.
Well, this is the fourth one after 30 years, though.
Yeah. Yeah, so reminds me a little bit of when they rebooted The Great Gatsby a couple of years ago with Leonardo DiCaprio. Remember that?
Yeah, at the end of the day, you know, how often are they playing Star is Born on TV? If it ain't playing on TCM, where else are you catching it?
Oh,
and
sure.
So when you reboot it every 30 years, and this is a movie that they've been trying to get off the ground for the longest. Remember, that at one point it was Bradley Cooper and Beyonce, or somebody with Beyonce, and Clint Eastwood was going to direct it. They could never get it off the ground, but they finally did now.
Yeah, and it looks really good, man. And, you know, it looks like prime awards material, man. So it's always funny. While we got a couple of minutes, explain to people when you hear, like, I'll throw around terms like it's award season or these are awards, Oscar types films, which a lot of that comes out of, you know, Telluride and Toronto and some of the other festivals, the New York Film Fest that'll happen as well in October. Explain, Wilson, in your words, what that phrase means to the audience.
Well, you know, you get a lot. I think when they start talking, it's awards worthy and so forth. You know, that's what people care about in the fall. It's like, it's just like anything else, a political race. You know, you need to get the buzz going. At the end of the day, just to kind of go sideways, if, you know, when Trump goes up for re-election, whoever he's going to go up against has to be talked about now or coming up soon, you know. Because he's got such a popularity level, whoever comes up just can't be someone that you just heard of out of the blue. you've got to build some time so that the audience knows who's who. So the same thing comes up with these films. So when these films get played at festivals, and you got a lot of people who review movies, who talk about the Oscars, and they're mentioning their name, it's already starting to spark. So then by the time it goes to other festivals, people have an eagerness to see it. I remember last year when Darkest Hour went there, and that became one of the biggest films that people wanted to see because they had already gotten buzz for Gary Oldman, that I got shut out of screening. And there was a good 300 people behind me online. And I was like, okay, this is a movie that people need to see. And obviously, look where it ended up. He ended up winning the Oscar.
He shouldn't have did, man. And the whole situation to me, man, even after having done this now for like over 20, almost 30 years now of doing this, is all funny to me because it's kind of like, you know, like the high school prom award season. It's like a 3-month prom period. You know, people get dressed up. You go to different shows. You're bouncing around from this show to this show to this show. You and I and journalists like us get a chance to cover them. Some of them we actually attend. So it's a lot of fun, man. I mean, you know, I always look forward to that 6-week period, man, between mid-November till probably the end of the year. It's kind of like film critic Christmas, man.
Yeah, you know, at the end of the year, it's like, okay, what do we need to see? You know, and that's the thing. Like, you want to be in a conversation, because if you're not in a conversation, no one cares. You know, you're either going to be that guaranteed blockbuster movie that we know has no shot for an Oscar, but we just want to see because we just want to be entertained. You know, but if you're that independent film, it's hard to compete with films that are already getting buzz. It's no different than you take, for example, the Tony Awards. If you don't get a nomination, people are not going to go see your show once the nominations come out. Because all that people, you know, because people use those nominations for free advertising. Oh, this show got 3 nominations. This show got 7 nominations, and so forth. So when people look at your show, no matter what kind of buzz you got, if they look at it and goes, they didn't get anything.
Right. They got shut out. That's it. No, I'm not going to see that. That didn't do anything. All right.
Yeah, so, you know, yeah.
All right, Wilson, we got about a minute to go, man. And as I said, man, before we let you go every week, man, tell people where they could follow all your content. And if you don't know Wilson Morales and you haven't heard him on this show before, this brother is in the know. I look at his IG and I go, damn, do your thing, Wilson.
Well, you can always follow me on blackson.com, same word you use for Twitter as well as Instagram.
So you're not going to say anything about the damn on the IG comment? You're just going to let that one just roll over your head and not say anything, huh?
You know, it's coming up, just before I let you go, obviously, I saw Black Klansman, Spike Lee's latest film, and I'm sure we'll talk about it down the road, but right. Just to let people know early, it's worth seeing.
Oh, yeah, man. We talked about it last night, man. That's what we do. All right, so, yeah. Brother, as always, it is a pleasure. I'll be in touch because I got to relay some news to you anyway. And thank you for what you told me last night. It actually worked out well.
Okay.
All right, sir.
Talk later.
All right. It's always a pleasure, man. Take care, Wilson.
Take care.
All right. And, of course, that was Wilson Morales from blackfilm.com. He joins us at the top of every show. We're going to take a break right now. We're going to come back on the other side and talk Black Klansman with the co-writer, writer-director Kevin Wilmot. You guys are listening to Keeping It Real with Film Gordon at 96.3 HD4, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. And coming up a little later on, we'll have reviews of the 6th installment of Mission Impossible franchise. And this one, of course, is Fallout. Now, our next guest is the writer, director of such provocative films such as CSA, Confederate States of America, and Destination Planet Negro. Recently, he collaborated with director Spike Lee as co-writer on his 2 most recent films, including the Grand Prix winner from Cannes, Black Klansman. I want to welcome back to the big show my man, 100 grand University of Kansas film professor, Kevin Wilmot. So, brother, what's going on?
Hey, baby, how you doing, Kev?
Hey, man, I try to see people always talk to me and they go, man, you don't really know them people, man. You just had to interview them. I'm like, nah, me and Kevin, we kind of cool like that, man. So,
we go way back, dude.
We do. So before I start talking to you about Black Klansman, man, let's just clear this up for the audience, man. You and I connected initially because I had an opportunity to see CSA. Back in the day, and I thought CSA was friggin' brilliant, man. And I was like, who made this movie? Who is this guy? So I do some research, and I sent you, I don't know if I sent you an email or I called you.
And
we talked, and we hit it off ever since, man. So I'm like, man, you got something new coming out. I need to see it, bro.
Yeah, you know, anybody that ever gets stuff, I have to say, they're clearly a genius. So you're clearly a genius.
Oh man, well absolutely so, brother. So so let's talk, let's speed up a minute and before I even talk to you about that, I know that you initially connected with Spike Lee because Spike Lee felt like I did when he saw CSA and, you know, agreed to put his name on it to help market the film to bring butts into the seats. So talk about the collaboration from that time to now of working with Spike Lee.
Well, yeah, you know, he was really great in terms of just, you know, reaching out to me and he really loved the film. And so, you know, what happened was that, he asked if he could, you know, present the film and presented by Spike Lee. And, We just kind of, you know, of course, you know, stayed in touch ever since. I mean, the first thing I always tell this to my students, you know, the first thing somebody tells you when you get opportunity is, do you have any other scripts? And I had the film that turned into Shire Black. At that time, it was called Gotta Give It Up. Hmm. And he read that and loved it. And we tried to get that film made, you know, 15 years ago.
Wow.
And,
okay.
And, you know, had two readings of DreamWorks. And at that time, Jennifer Lopez was going to play Lysistrata.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it didn't quite work out. And you know, 3 years ago, so called me and said, you still have that script? And I said, yeah, I still got it. He said, well, let's set it in Chicago and call it Shire Pack.
Nice.
And that's when that. But he's always stayed in touch with me. You know, occasionally when KU basketball team gets, we either win or we get beat, you know, he, like a few years ago, we got beat by Bucknell early in the tournament, and he just sent me a text that said, Bucknell.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate
yeah, thanks
that.
A lot, bro. You know, the whole town's in full depression here, you know.
Bucknell.
But yeah, you know, he's been really great to work with.
All right. I'm online with writer-director as well as University of Kansas professor Kevin Wilmot. Kevin co-wrote Black Klansman. So, you know, you and I had a conversation, man. So, you know, I'm not going to really tell them all the stuff I told you about the film. But, you know, the thing that I love about this brother here is I can pick the phone up at any point and give you a call. You know, whether I'm sitting in a movie theater and you're at Martha's Vineyard and I'm giving you reports of what I'm reading on IG, I'm like, hey, Kevin, what's up, man? People are, there's a lot of shade online, bro. What's going on?
Yes, yes. Well, you know, man, you know, I tell you, one of the things I like about Spike, and I think one of the things we have both in common is that, you know, we make films based on what we believe in.
Right.
You know, I mean, I live in Lawrence, Kansas. I don't live in the Hollywood. I never lived in Hollywood. You know, I mean, you want to call it. And, you know, and mainly because I want to make films about the things I cared about. And that's, and sometimes you please people and sometimes you don't, you know.
All right.
And that's kind of the way it works, you know. You just kind of trying to do your thing the best you can.
All right, Kevin, I'm online with Kevin Wilmot. Kevin, I don't know what it is. I'm not sure if you can hear it, but your phone is kind of doing the in and out thing. Like, it's sounding choppy.
Oh, wow, okay.
Like the connection. So I just want to make sure we're on point with that. But I'll let you know if it gets any worse. But So let's talk a little bit about Black Klansman. So as I said, I shared what I thought about the film and had a long conversation with another colleague who was on our first segment, Wilson Morales, who really liked the film last night, and he and I had a long conversation about it. This film has been painted as kind of Spike Lee's comeback film. And I would agree that I think it takes him back. It almost is a film that reminds me of his roots from like the 80s, late 80s, early 90s. That style of filmmaking that he employs with this film. For the audience who is unfamiliar with the film or may have just seen the trailers, give them a little overview of what BlacKkKlansman is all about.
Well, BlacKkKlansman is based on a true story. Ron Stallworth was the first or one of the first black policemen for the Colorado Springs Police Department. And he kind of quickly became a detective. And there was issues that he had on the force, but more importantly, they put him in charge of racial issues he had on the force. But more importantly, they put him in charge of kind of monitoring all the radical groups at that time. And, you know, this is the 70s, early 70s. And you know, there's a lot of radical groups, you know. So you know, he's just sitting at his desk one day, in the detective's room, and he sees the newspaper, and in the newspaper there's an ad for the Klan. The Klan are looking for new members, and it's got a phone number, and so he calls the number. And he's so young and so new to all this. He's pretending to be a white racist on the phone, and he uses his real name, Ron Stallworth, when he's talking to the head Klan guy, and they fall in love with him over the phone and want him to become a member. And so he has the opportunity to infiltrate the Klan. Of course, he can't do it because he's black, and so they have to get another policeman who is played by Adam Driver. And they kind of combine a total Ron Stallworth, a black Ron Stallworth and a white Ron Stallworth, and the white Ron Stallworth will infiltrate the Klan physically, and the black Ron Stallworth will continue to have a relationship over the phone with the Klan, and that's really what the movie's about.
Well, you know what's interesting, man, as you explained it, and I'm sitting there laughing, that this is the sort of story that if somebody was making up a story, we'd make this up. But the fact that this is real, I'm like, I was sitting there going, wow. But this was a time, you know, there's a joke that Dave Chappelle had in one of his shows where he said, you know, I come from a dark time, man. You know, I didn't even know who was on the phone until I picked it up. So this scene where Ron calls up the head of the local KKK, I guess, and uses his white voice, you know, to borrow Sorry to Bother You, uses his white voice.
Right.
It's very interesting phenomenon that in a way may not make sense now in 2018, but makes perfect sense of something that could have happened like that 40 years earlier. So
no doubt about it.
So when it came to,
I think most black people have had similar experiences of that. You know, I remember I've had meetings in Hollywood where, early, this is like 20 years ago when I was first starting, and you know, you walk into the room and they go, "Oh, wow, he's black."
You know? oh, you're Kevin Wilmott. Oh,
oh yeah, oh, you're Kevin Wilmott. Okay, wow, I thought you're a white guy. You know, I remember, you know, going to rent apartments and the realtor would say, well, you know, some of those places I told you on the phone, that's not going to work out, you know, because you sounded white over the phone. And then when they see you, those places, they can't rent to you now, you know? So, I mean, especially like in the, say, the 70s, early 80s, that was kind of a common kind of experience for folks.
Right. Well, man. So whose idea, who brought the screenplay? Because I know I heard that Jordan Peele initially had the screenplay, didn't think it fit his sensibilities, and brought Spike in. So was it a case that he brought Spike in and then Spike brought you in? Or how did this story fall to the two of you guys to write it?
Sure. Well, Spike got a call from Jordan Peele, and they had a script that they weren't satisfied with it. And he wanted Spike to maybe consider directing it. And so Spike gave me a call, and we went out. We talked about the script, you know, kind of identified the problems and kind of, you know, created our own take on what we could do in terms of rewriting the script. So then we went out and met Jordan and Blumhouse, the Jason Blum, you know, those guys. And those guys had worked with him on Get Out. You know?
Right.
So we met with them, and they really loved our take. And the only thing that Jordan Peele really said was, like, make it funny.
You know? Is that what he said?
Yeah, you know, and I think the thing that he was saying is obviously not, it's not a comedy by any means, but what I think he was saying was, you know, bring out the absurdity of the situation, and when you do that, you know, and you really kind of required to get really dramatic in that sense, and really kind of go to the depths of what the ugliness is with all of this, and that's really where the humor is, and so that's really kind of what we tried to do.
All right, so you know, without divulging too much about the story, man, you know, there's some cameos that you have in here that I think are very, very powerful, that work really well in the film. But I want to talk about your lead actor that you used, John David Washington, who's the son of Denzel Washington. He's a busy guy. He had two films I saw at Sundance early this year, Monsters and Men and Monster. And it's got another film that's coming out after this. To me, this is clearly the best work I've seen him do. What was it? Was it Denzel talking to his son and saying, you know, get ready for Spike? I've worked with him four times. Or did you and Spike both see something in him, you know, that to cast him? What was it that in your estimation made his performance so solid in this film?
Well, you know, Spike and the Washington family go back a long way, and they're very close, and he's known, I think, John David, since he was born, really. So you know, I'm sure there's a real comfort level there with Spike, but it was Spike's choice from the very beginning. I mean, he kind of said from the very beginning that he thought this was a good part for him, and. I think that was just his take on it, and he never really looked back, and I don't think there was anybody really else considered, and I just think he just fits the part incredibly well. I mean, I think so oftentimes with actors, I think it's the kind of role it is, it's the opportunities, and it might be the comfort level he has with Spike, but he's great in the film. He's really, really great.
No, he really is, man. One more time, I'm online with the co-writer and also director, not director of this film, but the co-writer of BlacKkKlansman, Kevin Willmott. Kevin, you know, so you recently have had some success. I would say some success with these last couple of films with Spike Lee. I haven't heard you call me up, or I haven't read anything that you're developing anything else. What's going on with you, man? I want to see you climb back in the director's chair.
Well, man, I've been so busy writing, man. I was so funny because I started as a screenwriter, really, and then moved into my own movies and let that go for, you know, must have been 15, 20 years since I've really worked for. You know, a company or anything like that, but since Chirac, you know, that's really kind of opened up again, and I wrote something else for Amazon, and I've written another thing with Spike here recently, and so I'm kind of putting together, developing another project now for another company. So, you know, I want to get back to making my own films. I just haven't had time, unfortunately. But, I mean, it's a good problem to have, you know.
No, I agree. I agree. So, for you, what's more fulfilling, man? Is it more fulfilling sitting in a room and, you know, just creating these characters and these stories? Or is it in your comfort zone much better when you're sitting in that director's chair, man, kind of like orchestrating the action?
Well, I tell you, man, I think, Tim, that a big part of it is ultimately kind of, for me, what's what I'm working on. You know, all the movies I've had the chance to write and make and have all been movies that I really kind of could care deeply about. You know, I feel, you know, projects that I could really invest in, and they weren't jobs. They were you know, movies. Even I'm working for somebody else. They were movies that I cared about and that I would have chosen for myself if I had the opportunity. So, you know, in that sense, I mean, you know, that was kind of partially why I don't live in New York and L.A. I mean, it was always trying to concentrate on the things I believed in and the things I thought I could do well. And amazingly, kind of fortunately, you know, the blessings of these things have kind of come my way now. And so it's been really great in that sense. I mean, I feel like, you know, it's a real blessing that I've got to work on these things that are things that I truly believe in.
All right. One of the things that I really wanted to make sure I didn't forget to talk to you about, I was doing my research, which I didn't really have to do Kevin Wilmot research, but I said, let me just see what's out there. And I saw an interview that I think you did locally, man, where I guess they must have asked you about the politics of the film and, you know, how the film sort of ends and how that, you know, Spike and you in the film with the screenplay kind of tie in today's current events along with what happened 40 years earlier. How effective, and this is there's no right answer to this question, but I just want to hear your thoughts on it. How different would this film have been if it was released, say, 2 or 3 years ago when we had a different leader in the White House?
Well, you know, I think it would still be effective, but it would have a different kind of effect. I mean, the thing that Trump has brought to American reality is that, you know, I think that all of us, in some in deep kind of ways and others in more remote ways, believe that Obama kind of represented at least a step forward in terms of race relations in America. You know, some people thought it was post-racial. I think most Black people didn't believe that. But I think most people felt like, you know, we really kind of, you know, this is a great thing. I mean, most, you know, when I was a kid, we never could imagine Obama being president ever. I mean, we used to joke about that.
Right.
But, you know, the fact that Trump shows up and the Klan and the neo-Nazis have had a rebirth, I mean, I would almost really go so far as, I mean, there have been three Klans in the United States. It was the first Klan after the Civil War, and then the second Klan after Birth of a Nation in the 1920s. And I would say this is the third rebirth of the Klan. And it's because there's a, you know, it was a racist in the White House. And so, you know, I mean, clearly the movie, you know, you can't deny it. I mean, we Spike and I have joked that Trump and David Duke kind of wrote themselves into the film. You know, we didn't write them into the film. They wrote themselves into the film.
Right.
And that's just kind of the reality of it. And so it just gives the film just kind of another level of importance, you know, and relevance. I mean, people can't deny that the Klan is alive and well and prospering in 2018.
No, they cannot. And I love, there's one particular scene in the movie, and I want people to go in and get the experience. So I'm kind of tiptoeing or walking on eggshells as I talk about
sure.
certain stuff. But there's one scene in particular, which I talked to you about, the juxtaposition between, you know, what I call the power sources, you know, Black power, white power. And,
right.
And I thought the way that it's written on the script and then the way it's delivered and shot and edited, how it kind of bounces back and forth. I thought it was genius. I thought that, you know, even it's perfectly, if I could use this for this word, syncopated. It's almost like
right.
a piece of music, man, where, you know, it fits in perfectly. How, when you guys were creating this and writing these scenes and trying to kind of put this together, was there a conversation actively that you guys are thinking about or thinking through this or how do we deliver this? I'm just trying
right.
to get some insight on that because I thought it was really well
sure.
done.
Well, I think a lot of that is Spike and the editor. I mean, you know, that's a big part of it. But I think the other part of it was that you know, we really tried to embrace the 70s element of it, you know, in various ways, but especially the Black Power movement. And, you know, Sylvie Carmichael, Kwame Ture is in the film, and he's made one of the major characters in the movie, and really trying to really capture that Black Power, Black Panther kind of moment that we had in during those times. And so I think that it kind of allows, you know, it allowed them to kind of bounce back and forth. And you know, Spike is the, you know, he's really, you know, kind of, he's obviously musically inclined and, you know, really, you know, has always been, that's been a part of his movies, I think. And so I think he just kind of had fun with all of that. And so, you know, we really just wanted to capture that moment. And just, like you say, you know, it's such a great juxtaposition against, you know, David Duke and the Klan. And, but, you know, I don't really think you fully kind of realize it until you probably get into the editing room. I mean, it's all there in the script. But I think when you see how strong those visuals are, it kind of brings everything to another level. And I think that's what you're getting at, Tim. I think that, you know, it's almost like, you know, that's the beautiful thing about film, is that you kind of create it on the page, and you understand it on that level, and you understand that it's working technically as a script. But then after you shoot it and you get in the editing room and then you stick things together, and it just takes on another level. And I'm kind of pretty sure that's what happened here.
All righty, one more time. I'm online with the co-writer of the upcoming film Black Klansman. It's Kevin Wilmot. Kevin, I got a couple minutes to go, man. I'm looking through your Wikipedia page. We got to get somebody to get in there, man. You got students at KU, man. Get somebody in there, man, to kind of to bolster you. you bigger than this, man.
I know, man. I gotta help. But see, I'm so Mister. I don't give a doggone. You know but I'm gonna have somebody hook me up a little bit.
Yeah, man. It's almost like, you know, I was telling somebody about. When I watch a bad Spike Lee movie, I want to say, Spike, man, just look in the mirror. You Spike Lee, man. You bigger than this. So it's the same thing with you. Kevin Wilmot, you bigger than this, man. Don't have one paragraph on Wikipedia, man.
No, I know somebody wrote like about a 5-page analysis of CSA on Wikipedia. And you ain't, like, man,
use
I
that.
I just have to write my page, man.
All right, man. So Black Klansman opens in theaters on August the 10th. I am so excited for you. I can't wait to find out what those opening weekend numbers are going to be. And I might do it Spike Lee, man, and send you a number. You know, you'll get a text. 35. But, brother.
Well, hey, man, you know, it's been a great ride, man. I mean, you know, being in Cannes and having that response was a beautiful moment. And I just hope, I hope that, you know, people will check it out. I think it's a very entertaining film and one that has a lot of importance to today, unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately is absolutely correct. So, brother, I will be in touch because, you know, we got some other stuff we need to talk about offline. But it's a pleasure to have you back on the show, man. Don't let 300 more episodes go by before you come back, because that's exactly what happened this time. You were on 300 episodes ago.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. Man. Well, let's hook up again soon, brother. Man.
All right. Not a problem. You take care.
All right, Tim. Thanks, brother.
Bye. All right, and of course, that was writer-director Kevin Wilmot. As I said, he is the co-writer of Black Klansman. He also worked with Spike Lee on Chi-Raq. We're going to take a break right now. When we come back on the other side, we're going to talk all things Mission Impossible with the cast. You guys are listening to The Big Show, keeping it real with Film Gordon, and we'll be right back.
Hey, this is Kevin Wilmot, director of CSA, Confederate States of America, and you're listening to The Big Show, keeping it real with Film Gordon on Film Gordon Radio.
Welcome back to the show. And earlier this week, the only film show from around the country to cover the U.S. premiere of Mission Impossible Fallout was yours truly. And we were deep on the red carpet for all of the coverage. Now, producer and star Tom Cruise was a pro's pro, not just spending almost 3 hours talking to each member of the press, but also spending time with the fan winners that were lucky enough to be at the event. Now, we also spoke with writer-director Christopher McQuarrie, co-star Simon Pegg, Michelle Monaghan, Rebecca Ferguson, and the lady herself, Angela Bassett.
Hello.
Mr. McQuarrie, Tim Gordon. How are you? This is your fifth film with Mr. Cruise.
My ninth film, unofficially.
Ninth?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So what is there about working with him, or what you discovered of working with him, that he brings your writing to life or your style of directing to life?
He serves very good coffee. If he didn't serve the coffee, I would. No. He and I describe our relationship as one long conversation about movies that is occasionally interrupted by making a movie. We hit it off from the very first moment we met, loved the same films, had kind of the same filmmaking sensibility. And when you find somebody like that that you like working with, why not keep doing it?
So you guys have taken a story television show and you've elevated it to like another level with these films. Now you've directed two of them. What is it about this story? Is it working with Tom Cruise, or is it something rich that you're bringing to this story?
You know what it is? The what this franchise enables you to do, specific to working with Tom, an actor who's willing to do anything you can think up, you can do things that nobody else has ever done. And going to work and knowing that you're doing something that's never been done before, not just once on a movie, but every day on a movie, that's pretty addictive.
Now, you've had a pretty storied career, and I just want to let you know, The Usual Suspects is like an all-time classic. Is there any way that you can see reviving any of those characters and try to do a spinoff of that film?
I tell everybody, if I ever do that, it means I have the greatest idea in the world, or I am so in debt that I needed the money so badly.
Last,
or both.
You know. I was going to say, last question.
Yeah.
The Usual Suspect question. When you create something like that, of course, you never know how folks are going to respond.
Yeah.
Did you know going in at some point when you were writing that I may have struck a chord, or I may have created something a little different?
No. You know, the lesson I've learned is when you think that, you're going to get kicked in the ass. It's the same thing with this movie. We had our heads down all the way right up until we let this thing out into the world. We didn't know what we had. We didn't know how people were going to respond. And that's the only time I feel at ease is when I'm uneasy. Never take it for granted.
Christopher McQuarrie, thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
All right.
Great
you enjoy.
Got the shirt.
Tom Cruise, Tim Gordon, how are you?
Hello, Tim, how are you doing?
Sir, I watched this film last night, and the one thing that I thought of is that you are a psychopath. You are a maniac. Even though we know you had a halter on, how is it that you're doing these stunts? I know you love adrenaline. You're a Jersey guy. I am as well. But, my God, talk about the stunts that you performed, not just in this film, but across this franchise that you've worked on.
Yeah, it's been intense. It's been a lot of fun because, you know, when you're working on stuff, I mean, I like to do things in my own life. I like to climb and hike, and I like to fly airplanes. I'd never flown a helicopter, really. I wasn't licensed, so I trained, you know, to be licensed in this. Spent a year and a half training on helicopters. And then I got the, you know, great pilots to kind of really show me the edges of a helicopter. Because in an airplane, you know, an airplane wing will stall, and you can spin, you can recover it. And with a helicopter, you don't have that opportunity. And I did a film, you know, obviously I did the aerial sequences in Top Gun, and then we really, modern was American made. We trained in that, and we kind of studied and learned everything we could for that to be able to bring it into, you know, this mission and see what we could accomplish story-wise with that.
So here we are now, your career, 1981, I think, was your debut film. I feel like I've been watching you all my life. You really love what you do. And what do you think? And I know you've got tons of films left in you, but legacy-wise, what do you think up to this point, almost 40 years that you've been doing this?
It's amazing. It was my dream. It was my dream to be able to do that since I was a kid. And I remember I was making taps back in, that was in 81. That to have that opportunity to, would I, you know, still be able to be here and doing it and be able to do it at this level, it's a privilege. And it's something I'd never take for granted. And as I said, my passion for cinema has only grown. It hasn't waned at all. It's kind of incredible. it's just amazing. So that's what I think, and I've learned everything to try to apply that to audiences and see what can I do. So it's every day on a set, and I know McHugh feels the same way. It's something we don't take for granted. We're constantly pushing ourselves, you know, never rest on our laurels, and you know, to have this moment, we're going to share it with the world.
Congratulations. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right.
I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
Simon Pegg,
hey,
Tim Gordon, how are you?
Hey, Tim.
I've watched you in a lot of your comedic roles, and then I watch you in these films. Is it wonderful for you to be able to kind of balance and kind of play between both worlds, where you're doing heavy drama, big budget drama, and then you're doing comedy?
Oh, it's great. It's fun. And, you know, Benji is quite a lighthearted character. He's sort of the most human of the group in a way. I think he's the kind of audience's way in, because he actually says what he's thinking, which is, why the hell are we doing this? And are you serious? And I'm frightened. And I think that brings a degree of sort of humor to that role. But, yeah, I mean, I didn't set out to be a comedic actor particularly. I think I wanted to do Shakespeare when I was at college. So, you know, I want to be able to do everything. And I've specialized in comedy, but I'm looking to kind of branch out into serious stuff now, which will make everybody wish that I was being funny.
Well, you know, I really appreciate you in these films, so I didn't want it to be a slight or anything.
No, absolutely. But, I didn't take it as one.
But I basically was just basically saying that I love the work that you've done with Edgar Wright and all of those films and those trilogies that you've worked on.
Yeah.
How is it working with these guys coming back, you know, because you guys are shooting these films, like, there's like an hiatus, maybe 3-4 years in between as they develop stories. How is it when you guys get back together? Does the chemistry feel right?
Oh, always. It's like we've never been away, you know. I mean, we keep in contact between films, but we don't see each other that often because we're always busy on other things. We might bump into each other at something or you know, which is always nice. But when we get back together, it's like we've never been apart. And that's always a really helpful thing, so we can hit the ground running. We've got that chemistry. We've got that understanding of each other's processes. And it really sort of adds to the experience.
Now, the rumor is that this is the final film in this franchise, but it seems like there's still more story to tell.
I haven't heard that rumor.
Okay.
As far as I know, we're going to keep going until he says quit. And I don't know if that will ever happen because he's not a quitter. So it'll be interesting to see.
Final question. It terrifies us watching Tom and all of these insane stunts that he tries in this film. How do you guys on set, when you're going through these shot sheets and you're looking at these scenes are coming up?
Well, it's all right for you because you know he survives because he's over there. But when we watch him do it, we don't know if he's going to make the end of the day. So it's even more terrifying to watch him doing them.
Sir, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Simon, you take care.
Are you going to do another Star Trek?
Michelle Monaghan.
No.
The last time I saw you, we were here for Fort Bliss.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, years
that
ago.
Makes me so.
So now watch this. I feel personally responsible that you have blossomed since the last time I've seen you.
Well, bless your heart. It might be the dress with the bow.
Okay. It is the dress with the bow. So in this film, which I had an opportunity to see last night, you were really... You're very pivotal to the story.
Yes, it is. You know, it's a storyline that I felt like there was some unfinished business. You know, it was nice to get the call from McHugh, and he said, you know, listen, we want to bring Julia back. And I thought, yes, you know, it's a storyline that I love. I love playing, but more than that, it's a part of the franchise that I also love as a fan. And so it was great to come back and kind of explore that and that emotional side of Ethan and. And, you know, it's just really great working with Tom. I appreciate it so much. I appreciate it the first time, the second time, and you know, third time's a charm as well.
Now, you've had an amazing career. I've looked at your filmography.
Yeah.
So when you look at films or nights like tonight, when you're here as a part of a huge franchise...
Yeah.
How does it kind of make you feel as an actor?
Oh, it feels me. It's not lost on me. I have a tremendous amount of gratitude. You know, listen, this was a first lead role for me. You know, JJ and Tom took a real chance on me, and to be a part of it 10 years later, it's incredibly fulfilling, you know, and I've done a lot of things that I'm proud of in between, as you know, and, you know, I'm really living a dream.
Now, I talked to you before, and it's ironic because, as I said, small film the first time, huge film this time.
Yeah.
What's your preference? Is it?
Both. You know what? Honestly, my heart really is with indies. I love little indies.
And you're really good in these
indies. Yeah, I appreciate them. I appreciate getting to put myself in other people's shoes. It's a tremendous honor to be able to do that, specifically with something like Fort Bliss, you know, that enlightened me to a world that I wasn't privy of, as you know. And, you know, it's forever changed me. And to be able to continue to explore roles, to explore the human condition without judgment is, you know, this is why I get to do this. You know, this is why, you know, it's a gift to me to get to do that.
Michelle, it's always a pleasure to see you. I look forward. I know you've got a new series that's going to be shooting partially here.
Yes, that's right. Messiah, it'll be coming. We're coming here for October. It's going to be on Netflix sometime next year, but it's really good.
You take care. You enjoy your evening.
Okay, thank you so much. Nice to see you again. Thank you for the support.
That's you?
That was you on your husband's birthday. When you were here for another film you were promoting years ago. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
You've joined the franchise now in a role which we won't disclose. How does it feel when you got the call and that you'd been watching these films, they've been making them for the last 10 years?
22 years.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry. The last 22 years.
Yes,
how does it feel joining the franchise?
Oh, it's pretty exciting. I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe they were giving this brown girl a call.
Yeah.
Ladies.
And guess what? And you were great in that role.
You brought
what I call that Bassett intensity to the role.
Is that what you call it?
I actually do. I mean, I've been watching you. Well, I'm not going to tell you how long I've been watching you, but from the role I saw you in Boys in the Hood and the intensity you brought, I think there's kind of a trait, it's kind of your hallmark as I look at it in your roles. So as you're looking at these films and I look at the variety of work that you're actually doing, as an actor, how do you feel almost 30 years as it is now that, you know, the arc of your career, how do you feel it's gone?
I feel that it's going very well. I feel that it's been going in a way that I can be proud. I feel it's going in a way that's had real positive impact on audiences and on my community and the industry. I feel it's gone better than I could have imagined. If you get more than you expect or less than you expect, I've certainly gotten more. So I'll just keep going.
One final question before I let you go. You've had an opportunity to do a lot of different things. Is there anything out there that you still are striving for, a role that you really want, something that you would love to bring to the screen?
I would love to play that really, really duplicitous. I played badass, but that duplicitous, up to absolute no good. But of course, you can't tell her that, woman.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Angela, thank you. Rebecca Ferguson, last question.
Okay.
The White Queen.
You better be
the
good.
White Queen. The White Queen.
White,
the Mission
what did
Impossible.
Did you say the White Queen?
The White Queen.
White
I loved you in the White Queen.
Thank you.
So you add a lot of spice and texture to this story, and people always refer to it as badass and attitude. How much fun is it in this mostly all male universe being a person who's really kind of, you know, bringing a certain amount of fire to the role?
Je ne sais quoi to the screen.
Absolutely.
I think I am extremely lucky to be active and working as I am with the character I am in this time when things have been bubbling and sizzling and volcanoing, erupting. Not to the point that I wish it would, but we are gradually getting there and penetrating the surface of what equality actually is. I think what I loved doing... Your camera just disappeared. Or are you recording?
No, he is.
Oh my God! I was thinking.
I'm
my God! What just happened? Did they just walk away from you?
No, they didn't.
What just happened?
They didn't.
They got bored with the gender equality. They were like, ish. Anyway, and I think I'm just. What I love about it is that there's a character with an arc and that serves a purpose, and that's what I want. I don't care about the screen time for women. It's bring purpose.
All right, I know you got to go because you got to run inside and go see this film. I'm hoping we see you in another installment of this film.
Well, me too. Keep on saying it, honey. Keep on saying it.
I asked MQ if this was the last one, and he said, I haven't heard the rumor that this is the last one.
No,
so.
And you know what? I think he's demissionizing right now. That's what he's doing.
You enjoy the film, and thank you for your time.
Thank
you. All righty.
Welcome back to our final segment. And this week's reviews are brought to you by thefilmgorton.com. Experience film through the eyes of a true film addict, me. Check out all of our film content at thefilmgordon.com. Now, this week, nobody wanted to put their film up against the juggernaut, but before we take a deep dive into this story, as always, cue the music. This week, one of the brightest stars in Hollywood history takes audiences' breath away in Mission Impossible Fallout. Now, the story picks up after the events when an IMF mission ends badly and Solomon Lane escapes custody and the world is faced with dire consequences. As Ethan Hunt takes it upon himself to fulfill his original briefing, the CIA begins to question his loyalty and his motives. Hunt finds himself in a race against time, hunted by assassins and former allies while trying to prevent a global catastrophe. Written and produced and directed by Christopher McQuarrie, the film stars an all-star ensemble which includes Tom Cruise, Ving Rhames, Simon Pegg, Rebecca Ferguson, Sean Harris, Michelle Monaghan, Alec Baldwin, Henry Cavill, Angela Bassett, and Vanessa Kirby. Now, in this clip, Ethan lays down the law in this action-packed film.
I know what you're thinking. Maybe they're not here for you. Maybe they're just here for me. Are you willing to take that chance? You have something I want. Right now, that makes me the only person you can trust to get you out of here alive.
I think I'd like to go home now.
Now, 2 years after the IMF captured terrorist Solomon Lane, an obviously haunted with guilt Hunt is pressed into action when he's faced with a decision that almost gets one of his own team killed. Now, when a new head of the IMF, director Alan Huntley, played by Alec Baldwin, and his CIA equivalent, Erica Sloan, played by Angela Bassett, clash, Hunt is forced to partner with the mysterious Agent Walker, Henry Cavill, to prevent plutonium from falling into the wrong hands. Despite the obvious friction between the two, the stakes increase when MI6 agent Ilsa Faust, played by Rebecca Ferguson, turn out in search of Lane, much to the chagrin of both Hunt and Walker. Now, writer-director McQuarrie does a masterful job of layering the story, creating a tension-filled romp that never lets the audience catch its breath. Now, the only director to helm two films in this franchise, McHugh's entertaining story is only bolstered by the insane stunt work that Cruise performs in what is the best installment of this long-running franchise. Now, since Cruise burst onto the scene in 1981's Tap, he has long established himself as one of the biggest box office stars in Hollywood history with an incredible 16 $100 million films to his credit. Now, instead of playing it safe, Cruise ups the ante, literally proving himself to be action personified. Whether running through the streets of Europe, high-speed motorcycle chases in city traffic, hanging from helicopters, and the unfortunate scene where he even broke his ankle, which they left in the film, Cruise truly gives his all, and in return, we are treated to a cinematic anomaly, a story-driven action film with an all-star cast that's deliciously entertaining as it is filled with dread with just how much will Cruise give until there's simply nothing left to give. Now, his main job is to give audiences a thrill or jolt, and if that's his motivation, my response to Cruise is simply mission accomplished. Over the past several years, we've seen plenty of contenders to the action throne, including Jason Bourne, Detective Hobbs, and even Robert McCall, but none of them bring the level of authenticity, commitment, and more importantly, the ability to literally try anything for audiences' enjoyment. Love them or hate them, there's a reason that Cruise has proven to be box office gold for more than three decades. He really cares, and it bleeds out over every frame of Fallout, which shows that there's still more adventures left for IMF's top agent. I gave Mission Impossible Fallout a B+. I really enjoyed this film. I've seen it twice. had a chance to talk to Tom Cruise. Yeah, as you heard in the interview earlier in the show, told him that he was a lunatic. I think some of those stunts are, like, absolutely amazing. So there we have it with that film. Now, well, that's it for us this week. And on behalf of our producer, Jessica Sturgis, we say in closing, please see something good at the movies. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you on the other side. I'm Tim Gordon, and we're out. Yeah, let's talk about life.